Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So, hello and welcome from Pebble Beach, California. This is Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here with Jérôme Legrand, who is part of Legrand Haas family. Mm-hmm. And part of the dynasty. He shares his responsibilities with two other siblings, two brothers. He's here presenting at Pebble Beach. I was a very lucky recipient of the largesse by tasting some of the vintage champagnes out of Magnum format, which was quite eye-opening. And we're sitting down and chatting about family history and really past, present, and future. So we'll start with the past. I know that this is a generational affair. Mm-hmm. How old is your champagne house?
It is, in fact, very young.
Oh.
My dad and my mother started the winery as it exists today in 1991. Prior to this, my dad was a winemaker for a company mostly owned by his brother and his uncle, for whom he worked 20 years as a winemaker. And my mom had a small champagne business as well. She started in the mid-80s a champagne brand named Brigitte Haas, after her name, and she was selling champagne mostly to Germany. And I think my dad has always been extremely independent in his way of thinking, and he arrived at a point in his career where it made no sense for him anymore not to be on his own. So he broke away from the other part of the family and started his own business with my mom and my two brothers at the time. They were involved in the company from the start. And that's what we have been doing as a family since 28 years now.
Wow. So historically speaking, you said it's a very young business. And this is, in fact, a business you highlighted very emphatically, that this is how you make your living.
Yes. There's we talked about romance just before this interview and how there is sometimes over romantic view on wine production. Wine production is a fantastic job. It is captivating. It is it fuels obsession in a way. You can't even imagine. However, we are in a world where part of our colleagues and other wineries we in our world are not family businesses anymore.
Yep.
And or are not the core business of a family.
Yeah.
If the difference makes sense. And we have to stay extremely careful compared to some other that could maybe go a little bit crazy. We have to think over, we have to make sure that this project is healthy and geared toward the future. And we have to say, we have to keep our feet on the ground because it's the only family business. It's what we have and that's it.
It's such a poignant remark that you made, the pragmatic, the practical part of the business, where, you know, to the outside world, it just looks so glamorous and so romantic.
And part of it is. Definitely part of it is. Being here, for example, is a big thing. And I think this is actually this kind of events that kind of makes people dream about wine.
That's very
well.
True. Yes.
And helps us dream about our own job and think over our own job. This is pretty good. But truth be told, for example, I'm 80% in production.
Yeah.
So 20% of my time is going out, meeting people, presenting wine, doing the fancy thing that everyone sees. But there's a lot of things that people don't see. And that's also the things we are passionate about.
Absolutely. So Champagne region, talk about glamour. I mean, I don't care who you are, you have heard of champagne, even if you're not an avid drinker. And it's almost synonymous with celebrity, with something very special, very happy, and obviously historic. What's it like to make wine in that region? Like, take me through this. You know, what's it like to own a champagne house?
Good question. What is it like? It's fantastic. That's what it is. First and foremost, it is. It makes me extremely proud and afraid, as
really?
Well.
There's trepidation.
To have to contribute to the family legacy.
Yeah.
And to play my role. So this is. There's a little bit of pressure as well.
I would think a lot.
It's a competitive world. Yeah. We have fantastic colleagues, and there's a good atmosphere within the region. This is one thing that is fantastic. Next week, for example, there's the Champagne Spring, Printemps de Champagne, and many producers organize events. Everybody goes from event to event. Mm. Everybody shares ideas. It's a very bubbly week, and it's really fantastic. What is it like day to day? It is production. It is stacking bottles, pumping wine, tasting, and tasting again. Mm. Planning for the next harvest as well. You know, just as you. Just as you prepare your house to welcome guests, or as you prepare your a room when you expect a baby, you expect the next harvest.
Sure.
So you make sure that you tend to your winery extremely well, so that when the harvest starts, everything is there. You are 100%
prepared
mentally to. Welcome it.
That's great. Yeah. So you're describing champagne as what you just mentioned, very convivial, a lot of camaraderie, information sharing. Is that in fact accurate? Do people really kind of come together in the wine community and talk to each other, share ideas, share pain points?
Yes, it is true. It is true. Of course, nobody shares with everybody. There's always styles and currents and groups and... But the truth is, and I think also internet and Instagram and Facebook, it helped a lot conveying ideas. Hmm. And I realized from Instagram that I got private questions, private messages from colleagues asking me about something I just did.
Huh. How about that?
And it's really good. I love it. Why did you do that? Have you made tests? Have you researched it? What is your take on this and this and this subject? So this I was not prepared to. I thought Instagram was kind of
it's more superficial, right? It's more about images.
Yeah, about images, and it's also geared towards the consumer.
Of course, yeah.
And less geared toward the trade, but not...
Not in depth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is.
No, that's
so
fascinating.
Yeah, this is.
That is so cool. I love it because, you know, social media often get a little, you know, bad rap because, you know, the superficiality that people perceive. But there's another side to it that does allow for that insight and true interaction, true engagement. Mm.
The only thing I have as a fear when it comes to social media is the way it profiles you. And then sends you down a well of advertisement that is only there for you because you're you, and you don't see the world outside anymore. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yes, it's a bubble.
Yes, it creates for each character a commercial world around you.
Yeah,
and also sometimes a political world around you of people who agree with your ideas.
Yeah.
If you're a liberal, you're only going to see videos of other liberals. If you are a conservative, you're only going to see videos from conservative people, you know, because they get to know you so well.
Sure.
And they don't want to surprise you. They want They want you to stay you, and this is something I don't really that I feel a little bit. On the other side of things, it's a fantastic tool for any business out there.
You know, it's such an astute observation that, you know, social media is, you know, supposedly you kind of own your own self on it, but it's not true, because the power of suggestion is exactly what that is, and you need to be careful. You'll wind up just being led and not really carve a spot for yourself. And I love how mindful you are about that. So to switch gears for a little bit, you're born in Champagne region, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so it's your hometown or home region. There's wine, there's sparkling wine made all around the world.
Yes.
Everywhere. And it's a great thing, I think.
Yes, bubbles are fantastic.
Yes, it bubbles. There's never enough. What is unique about Champagne, besides the obvious, which is, you know, huge amount of history, and I don't want to gloss over it, but I'm saying, what is special about making wine in Champagne?
I will brush over the obvious things, like terroir, a terroir that seems to be extremely well prone to produce very fresh, very pristine grapes from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier that make great sparkling. This is kind of a obvious thing, but it's... And there's also something else. Not everywhere, because there are out there some sparkling producer or sparkling regions that only make sparkling. But Champagne is the region where every grape of top quality gets into the sparkling production. Again, it's a generality, but very often when you see in other regions, part of the grape production is diverted to sparkling production for several reasons: young vineyards, difficulty in ripening. Mm-hmm. So parts of what you could consider second quality grapes are diverted to sparkling production. So at the end of the day, you cannot claim that you're going to make quality this way. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And I think, again, apart from a few exceptions, it is very, very easy to tell what is from Champagne and not. There's a poise, there's a concentration, there's a length, there's a complexity to the great wines made in Champagne that is very, very difficult to produce in other parts of the world. Again, if you want me to give you exceptions on that. There are a few sparklings that I love outside Champagne, of course. Mm-hmm. I think also the French production, when it comes to sparkling, is fantastic. It seems to me, and I've always found it a little bit unjust, that when people talk about sparkling, they talk about Champagne on one side, and then either Charmat methods or classic methods of other countries, and forgetting the world of sparkling within France.
That's really interesting. So, since you brought it up, what other sparkling wines do you like?
I like wines from, like, Charmat methods from Val de Biardenay or Conegliano, when they're made from great producer, great vigneron. This is a very, very small DOC, DOCG in Italy, but they make fantastic Charmat methods. I've had some pretty good sparklings from California as well, made partly by French companies that I've
Roder?
Found. This is one of them I found was quite complex. And here and there, pockets of wines that I love a little bit from Alta Langa as well, because there's an originality in the soil and in the tannin structure also sometimes that they have that is completely outside the Champagne spectrum.
Yeah.
So that I found quite interesting, but to me, champagne will, I think, for many, many years still be the beacon for sparkling production. And it's how can I say? As long as we're going to be copied in our process and in our concept and in the grape varieties we use for sparkling, we're going to be in the lead.
Yeah.
When it comes to quality.
That's really interesting because you mentioned as personal preferences. I assume you were referring to Cartizze in Conegliano Valdobbiadene, the wines made from Cartizze. Is that
actually
the regular Chard?
Yeah.
No, I was just curious.
I was thinking about companies like Giavi or Adami.
No, that's really interesting. Now I love those brands as well, but I just assumed that you like the wines from the hill.
I don't know them actually. If I knew them, maybe I would love them.
Oh,
as well.
I would love for you to explore that. It's a magical hill where they practice heroic farming. They literally
it is heroic farming. It is.
Yeah.
And most people don't even know that those wines exist. They have an idea of this place in the world. It's flatland, high yield, boring wines.
Not true.
And it is. To some, for a big part of the region, it is. Yeah. But there's also some absolutely crazy people out there making wines in conditions would make most champagne producers sweat.
Wow, that's so cool. So you stated earlier, if I understood you correctly, is that the what's now become international varieties, but there's a lot to be said about Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier. As the foundational grapes, and that's people that practice method champenois, that's the grapes they have to use, and in some cases it's self-imposed, right? Because there's other countries.
I think it is very much so self-imposed.
Yeah.
And sometimes I am a little bit angry at people who are outside an appellation contrôlée, and don't use the blank page that they have to write something original. You know, in Champagne we're always fighting with the regulation, but we try to find freedom within the rules. You know, we try to find originality within what we are allowed to do. Very, very rarely you get to design something from scratch, choose a piece of land, choose a grape variety, choose a concept of production. So when you have this opportunity and you don't seize it, and the only thing you do is copy Champagne, it's to me a little bit. And then copy Champagne to the extent that you will have the same kind of labeling, the same kind of foil neck label, and you will try to market it. Why would you do that? You know, I know exactly why you would do that, because it's easier to sell that way. But, you know, why don't you try to cherish the freedom you have?
Yeah, and they express maybe some indigenous white varieties.
Indigenous in the place they exist, or weird, or other, or, you know, it's...
So it's really interesting. Someone that grew up in Champagne and someone that's clearly, you know, very hands-on, it's so valuable to hear you speak of other regions that make sparkling wines that emulate without really trying to find their own voice. Is that kind of... what you're describing?
Yes, that's what I'm describing.
Okay. So you have a brand that, you know, is relatively young, like you described, and your family is very committed and involved. What is your brand identity? If you were to describe to me, like literally in a sentence, what is it?
Joyful complexity. bright wines. Accessible people, down-to-earth people, there is part of the marketing in Champagne from the bigger houses, the bigger brand that relies on luxury codes and, mm-hmm. and things that are more that capture the imagination a little better, mm-hmm. I guess. And they have a history of doing that, but we have to find our own voice. We have to also get people on board and make sure that they're not afraid of Champagne, you know, that they learn how to appreciate it without fearing it, that they serve it well, that they enjoy it at the right moment. So instead of investing a lot in marketing and merchandising and advertisement and all that, we try to spend as much time as we can on education, for example. Getting people to the winery, spending time with them, discussing with them, trying to learn how they see Champagne and tell them how we see it, try to help them grow in their appreciation of the region and of the wines.
That's really interesting. So again, you brought up early in the conversation that there's an intimidation factor, and Champagne is such a storied region that even though most of us would like to claim, of course we know Champagne, but most of us only know of it, or know the large brands that do spend a lot of money in marketing. So what is the heart of that region? What is it that you showcase to your customers, to your guests, when you show them?
The first thing is we bring them to the vineyard.
Yeah.
We try to put them in the middle of what makes this region a wine region, the vineyard. And also, when you're there, when you are on a high point, either in the Côte des Blancs or in the Montagne d'Oras, and you see a few villages and you see them, you understand. Yeah.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.